My name is Zed Goldberg, and I am speaking with Hallie Efron. Hallie Efron's parents were screenwriters. She's the sister of Nora Efron and Delia Efron. This is true?
This is true.
And Amy Efron. The author of six acclaimed novels, the Dr. Peter Zack series, who was your co-author?
His name was Don Davidoff, and we wrote as G.H. Efron.
G.H. Efron. You also wrote a how-to book, Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel, How to Knock 'em Dead with Style. And it was nominated for an Edgar Award in 2006. Very impressive. You're also the award-winning crime fiction book reviewer for the Boston Globe. You still live in Boston?
I live just south of Boston.
Okay. And you teach fiction writing?
I do.
Okay. We're going to start with a quote. I'm going to read a quote, and I want you to react to it, okay? Yes.
Yes.
If you're reading this book or thinking of reading this book, you must want to write a mystery. Big mistake. In fact, writing any kind of fiction is a big mistake. Who said that?
I have no idea. Who said that?
I think you did. I think it was in Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel.
So, I don't think I did.
So are you hoisting?
Oh, you know what? I think S.J. Roseanne said that in the introduction.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I'm quite sure I didn't say that.
So much for Wikipedia.
Yes, yes. Now, that was
Susie Roseanne wrote it. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, do you agree with that?
No, of course I don't believe in that. Read it again?
What did if you're reading this book or thinking of reading this book, you must want to write a mystery. Big mistake.
Yeah.
In fact, writing any kind of fiction is a big mistake.
No, I don't. I don't even think she agrees with that. I mean, yeah, honestly. I mean, writing fiction is really hard, and I think you have to be in it for the long haul. I mean, it's like knitting a mile-long muffler. I mean, you really have to have the staying power and the bullheadedness and the willingness to revise endlessly and the passion to do it, because it's not easy. But a mistake? No, I don't think it's a mistake, because the rewards are enormous if you only look at the wonderful people you get to meet.
This is absolutely true. I keep telling people, if there's no other reason to write mystery novels, it's because you get to meet other mystery writers.
Absolutely. And they are the most generous, lovely, welcoming
insane
group.
Funny.
Absolutely. And up all
drinking
night in the bar. Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah.
You go to BoucherCons, which are mystery conventions, and anything that goes on in the seminars and stuff, that's all nice. But it's 4 o'clock in the bar when this stuff really happens.
I know.
Having written this book about how to write a mystery novel, you have set yourself up like a big piñata. For people to say, well, you didn't do what you told us to do. Did you do what you told them to do?
I actually did. And it's funny, on my way here, was it on my way here? No, yesterday I was on my way to a book event, and I was waiting in the train station, and a woman came up to me and said she'd read my book. And she recognized me, and she said she had also read the writing book. And one of the things she said she enjoyed was seeing how I did the things that I was telling you to do. Which really surprised me, actually, because I thought I had sort of broken all my rules. Because one of the things I always tell people to do is plan. Think about what the major turning points are in the book. You don't need to outline it, but you need to know where you're going. And honestly, when I wrote this book, I was just so grateful to have an idea, because I had done all this collaborating. I thought I was never going to have an idea on my own. And I just started to write it, and I was not following the process I normally follow. But definitely, I think, just in terms of how you create suspense, and this is a big suspense novel,
mm-hmm.
how
yes.
you write action.
This is what they call a mystery thriller.
I call it psychological suspense. You know, thrillers, people always think of bombs going off. This is set in the suburbs. It's one reviewer called it suburban noir mm-hmm. that I liked.
Yes, I saw that. I thought that was fun. If you forgive my mentioning this, you've had reviews all over the map. I couldn't believe it. Everything from a D- in one publication.
Oh, dear. I didn't see that one.
Well, it's Entertainment Weekly, so people who read Entertainment Weekly move their lips watching television.
Yeah.
To good reviews in the New York Times. I mean, you've really covered the range.
To a star in Publishers Weekly.
Star in Publishers Weekly.
I know, and it was a Barnes & Noble recommended, and it's an Indie Next pick. People like it. I'm not a literary writer. I write.
Thank heaven.
I would love to be a literary writer. It's just not what I do.
Why? So you write pretentious stuff too that people won't ever finish?
My books, you start them, you get going, you get sucked in, you read it. It's a great airplane book. It's a scary Hitchcockian kind of book.
Glad you mentioned that word, because mm-hmm. One of the things that I like about, there's a genre of mysteries that I like, and it's taking somebody who's like a normal person who has no particular skills and throwing them into a pit of alligators and saying, have a good time.
Yeah. And I think that's what Hitchcock did is, I remember that in the movies, I think it's Suspicion, where is it Cary Grant is coming up the stairs and his wife is in bed. She thinks he's going to murder her. He's carrying a glass of milk and he goes up the stairs and the camera watches that glass of milk. And what Hitchcock did is he put a light bulb in the milk so it glowed eerily. And I always say that's what I do, what I try to do as a mystery writer is put the light bulb in the glass of milk. In the innocent, in the most innocent places, make it scary.
Mm-hmm. Hitchcock also said that movies are like life with all the boring parts taken out. Do you subscribe to that also?
Well, actually, you know, Elmore Leonard talks about leaving out the parts people skip. I don't know if you know that.
He also does take out all your adverbs, which is very, very difficult.
Well, which I do, actually. I search on. In fact, I recommend that in my writing book. Search on L-Y space and L-Y period and evaluate each one. Make sure you really need it because it's basically using an adverb. This is only going to be interesting to the writers out there, but using an adverb is the same as is analogous to telling instead of showing. If you say, he said happily, it's much better to say, how did he look or what did he do or you know, he hummed a tune. Something that shows the happiness, not she said happily, which is just shorthand for it. If you were writing nonfiction, a how-to manual, you'd use adverbs, but fiction's not a how-to manual.
He said with a big grin?
That would be much better.
That would be much better. Yeah, I can understand that. I went through that exercise with one of the books that I wrote, and it made me nuts. I took out...
Oh, taking out adverbs.
I took out three quarters of the adverbs until I finally, my eyeballs started to bleed, and I said, I can't do this anymore.
Well, there's a point at which every rule is stupid if you follow it slavishly, but the essence of it is still something to...
You know, I never mentioned the title of the book. I'm remiss on that. The title of the book is Never Tell a Lie. It's published by Morrow. William, I guess they don't use it anymore. It's just Morrow.
I don't know.
It says
Morrow Books, yep.
Morrow Books. Hallie Efron, and her last name is spelled Ephron. We start out with the typical suburban couple, I suppose, if there's any such thing. Ivy and David, and Ivy is very pregnant. And they live in a house that used to be lived in by somebody else, a nice old man that they liked, whose family somehow they got involved in knowing. And when they took over the house, he had a bunch of stuff left over, and they decided to have a yard sale. They feel a little guilty about getting rid of somebody's life like that, but hey, they don't really need the stuff. Can you set that scene for us?
Well, Ivy and David live actually in the house that my husband and I... It's the house that got away. When I was in my 30s and trying to buy a house for the first time, we almost bought this house. It's a massive Victorian in the town I live in, Milton, Mass. It's got leather wallpaper. It's got seven fireplaces with hand-painted tile surrounds, stained glass, a beautiful hand-carved staircase with a newel post and a statue, all this stuff I put in the book. And it had the man who owned it living in the kitchen with one light bulb, a wood-burning stove, and a bed. And the front of the house hadn't been painted in about 70 years. Fortunately, we were overbid. But that's the house I am imagining that I bought, and I am imagining all of his stuff in the house. And when I was pregnant, there is this thing called nesting where you just go completely mad in this period between being not a mother and being a mother, that sort of four-week period where you just want to clean everything. And so I was really channeling that side of me. And what happens to Ivy is she throws this yard sale, and a woman from her past shows up. She talks her way into the house. She goes inside, and she never comes out.
Spooky.
Very spooky, yeah.
Now, in my notes here, I have pregnancy. I was going to ask you if all of the pregnant woman lore in this book comes from your own life. I guess it does.
It does. It does. It's one of the things I realized I wanted to write about, and not something I could write about when I was writing with my male writing partner, as we were writing about psychology and the main character was a guy. In this book, I really wanted to write about that moment in a woman's life where, in my life, where I had been working for 10 years, my life was not in my hometown. It was you know, somewhere 30 miles away where I drove every day. My friends were there, my college friends I kept in touch with. And there I was, about to have a baby. I was sent home from work. You know, you have to wait for the baby to come. I don't know my neighbors. I don't know my town. I don't know if the baby's going to be born healthy. I don't know if I'm going to make it through labor the way I want to make it through labor. I don't know if my husband's still going to love me after my whole body. It's totally terrifying. So I wanted to write a woman in that kind of jeopardy, in that moment of about to step into the abyss. And, you know, you hope it's going to be a fairy tale ending. Happy baby, happy mother, blah, blah, blah. But we know, you know, it isn't always like that.
Well, this is a very plot-driven book, and I don't want to tread too heavily on the plot. So if I get close to something you don't want me to talk about, you can back me off. But not only is she in a particularly sensitive state of mind and chemical state, I suppose, but enough happens to cause doubts about her marriage, which she always thought was very strong. Little lies begin to pop up. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and that's sort of where the title came up, Never Tell a Lie. I mean, I don't mean it literally, never tell a lie, but what happens is this man whom she adores, whom she's married to, who she trusts totally, claims he doesn't know this woman that came to the yard sale, didn't really remember her from high school, even though they all went to the same high school. No, he didn't see her leave the house, but little by little, he gets caught in a web of lies, and the police want to know, why isn't he telling the truth, too? And she starts to doubt, and so here she is again at this very precarious moment, wondering if the one thing that she completely trusts in her life is she can trust him. Is she going to be alone with this baby now, or has she got or is her child's father going to be the man that she thought he was?
One of the things that goes on in this book is police focusing on one theory to the exclusion of everything else in the known universe. And this is a staple of crime fiction, certainly, and Law and Order. You see it on Law and Order every week, except you're supposed to root for this one theory of the crime. Did you do research on this? Did you actually work on police procedure, or did you just wing it?
No, I did work on it. As I said, I live in the town where I set the book, and one of the first things I did was make friends with my local homicide detective. And he's actually acknowledged in the book. He and his there was a second detective there, and I spent about a half a day in my town police department. He showed me, I sketched out the story, you know, suppose a woman disappears into a house and suppose there's possible evidence of a crime. How would you handle interviewing this young middle-class suburban couple? And he said, you know, he said, everything has changed since the little girl who disappeared, who was killed. What's her name? JonBenet Ramsey.
Oh, JonBenet Ramsey.
Everything has changed in police procedure since JonBenet Ramsey, because it used to be that a middle-class suburban couple would get, you know, kid glove treatment. Not so anymore. Now they really are. Everybody looks at that situation and says, I don't want to be the police officer that fouled up this crime scene by giving the homeowners a pass. And so he said, now we really do go by the book and we try to play husband against wife. And if they both have the same attorney, we're delighted because that makes it that much easier for us. And he talked about the different ways that they would try to divide and conquer for this married couple. And I used everything that they told me, including, you know, just the physical description in there of where people are booked, where they're held. It's all based on at least one version of this. And what you find in police procedure is it's really different in different towns. You know, we all think there's one kind of police procedure, and that's what we see on Law and Order, but
yeah,
it isn't.
Yeah. This is the point where I remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Hallie Efron. Hallie is the author of Never Tell a Lie, published by Morrow. One of the things that happens in this book, it's not even really a subplot. It's just more a, I don't know, something to set everything else, I guess. High school as a formative time in our lives. And as somebody once said, might have been Frank Zappa, that high school is the only experience that American children have with fascism. things happen in high school that mark us for the rest of our lives, unless we're lucky enough to rise above it. This colors a lot of what goes on in the book.
That is exactly what I was trying to write about, was here are three adults who 10 years ago were in high school together, and they were sort of emblematic of what I call the tiramisu of high school society, the layers, you know.
Sweet Nikki?
Yeah, then the top layer were the popular kids, you know, the football players, the cheerleaders, and that was David, Ivy's husband, who was the high school quarterback, and the middle layer, and that would have been more me. You know, I was the kid who, I was on the track team, but I didn't anchor the relay. I wrote for the paper, but I wasn't the editor. I was in the drama club, but I painted scenery, you know, watched the popular kids, wanted a date. And that's Ivy. And then in the lower tier, there are the kids who are victimized, the kids who are ostracized, the kids who are different. They're just not singing the same tune as the other kids. And even when somebody tries to befriend them, they don't really know how to respond. And that's Melinda. And so here we go, 10 years later, they're adults. They all look, I mean, they all look great. They're all reached their 30s without looking odd. And yet they have the scars of who they were when they were in high school and how that plays out.
Yeah, when you say scars, I mean, even the image we have, the popular image of the high school quarterback as a guy who later in life fails because not everybody gives him everything he always wanted like they used to do back in high school.
Right.
But David isn't like that.
David, I didn't want to write a caricature exactly like that. I wanted to write, he was the high school quarterback, but I mean, Ivy ends up marrying him, and if he'd been that caricature, she never would have. I mean, he's a kid who went to Boston College with a football scholarship, but walked away from it because he wanted to open a landscaping business. And he's a kid who wants to build his vocabulary, so he does crossword puzzles and carries around a dictionary. I mean, he's not your typical jock. Not that anybody really is your typical jock, honestly.
Well, I've met a few.
And so, yeah, I wanted to work against type and to make characters that were... I wanted the book to be believable.
Mm-hmm. What happens is that because Melinda never emerges, nobody sees her come out of the house after the yard sale, and bloody clothing is found in the trash cans in front of Ivy and David's house. It is assumed that for some reason Ivy has gotten really PO'd at Melinda and murdered her.
Well, that's one of the theories.
That's one of the theories.
But actually, where the... just giving some backstory, where the bloody clothing is found is in a wicker trunk.
Oh, that's right. Excuse me.
And I got to tell you where the wicker trunk comes from. My husband is a lunatic yard sailor. He every Friday night in our house, he's printing out maps and doing the classified ads from all the local people, planning it like Sherman's March. Saturday, he goes out. And one Saturday, he came home with a wicker trunk the size of a steamer trunk with a slanted back and wooden slats on the bottom and metal hinges and an old Polish label. And anyway, I thought, fabulous, this is so cool. We wrestle it out of the back of the station wagon, open it, and it's loaded with accounting ledgers. I mean, boring. And they stink. So.
Not even accounting in Polish.
No,
huh?
No, exactly. So, you know, we hose it down and throw some baking soda in, hoping we'll be able to use it someday. But it's still in our garage. But I put that wicker trunk into the book, and I filled it with the things that I had hoped would be in it when I found it, and of course that weren't. So much of this book is personal like that. You know, little bits of my life have been dropped in.
Everything is grist to the mill for
writers. It's really true, if you could just remember it.
So, you know, they say that writers have better memories to the point of being almost total recall for incidents in their life. Usually...
Oh, I just think we're really good liars.
Well, that's that too.
Yeah.
I mean, a book is what you know, what you can find out, and what you make up.
We make it up, yeah.
That's what it's all about. you have given Ivy the indispensable, which is a great best friend.
I have, yes.
Yes, Jody. Tell us about Jody.
Well, you have to know, too, my best friend from high school's name was Jody. So I liberally borrowed from my friends. But she's not my friend Jody. She's a completely made-up character. And Jody's just a friend. I mean, she's plump. Ivy's tall and lean. You know, when you create sidekicks in mysteries, and Jody's not really a sidekick, because this isn't a typical mystery, but she fills that role a little bit in that she's the person that Ivy confides in, so she's the sounding board, and that's what sidekicks do in mysteries. They help you they help your character formulate their ideas. So she is yin to Ivy Zhang. I mean, Ivy's tall and slim. You know, Jody is short and curvy and curly and very. She's hooked into Star Trek. She's a flake, but she's a great friend, and she's completely down to earth in terms of, you know, she doesn't think David did anything, and she doesn't think anything odd is going on here, mm-hmm. and she keeps Ivy grounded.
Yeah, I mean, well, Ivy's nuts for you know, 9 or 6 different reasons.
For good reasons.
Yes, for good reasons.
So she needs Jody.
Yeah, Jody is apparently unflappable. I've taught writing classes, mystery writing classes, on a couple of occasions, and one of the exercises I did I would give 3 unrelated items and ask them to write a 2-page story which uses all 3 of those.
Like what items would you give them?
Oh, a light bulb, a rope, and a catcher's mitt. You know, I would try to make them as disparate as possible.
Yeah.
You have set a scene here with a dumbwaiter, a straitjacket, and a pregnant woman.
And I'm not going to go there because that's the most. Yeah.
Yes. All I'm going to say is you did a great job with
that
scene.
Thank
you. I said, I wonder how the hell she came up with this.
Well, you know, the straitjacket is one of the things that Ivy finds in that trunk. And, of course, when you find a straitjacket in a book, you always wonder, what is the author going to do with this? Because that's what you do as an author. You establish things. You plant props for yourself. It's like, what is it, Chekhov, who said, if you put a rifle on the stage in the first act, it's got to go off in
that's
the third.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. It's exactly that kind of thing. So, you know, a straitjacket planted in the first act, you know it's going to be part of the plot. And hopefully I've surprised people in terms of how it actually gets played out.
Now, you did something in this book which I find admirable, and I want to praise you for it, which is giving us enough clues to help us figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
If you read this book alertly, I guess is the best way to put it, you will be able to figure out just exactly what's going on, and it doesn't diminish the ending of the book.
Yeah, and you know, I talk a lot in my writing book about playing fair with the reader, and it is actually one of the things that annoys me a lot in modern thrillers is they keep a lot from the reader, and they manipulate scene endings in a very artificial way in order to withhold something so that the reader will read the next 5 boring pages to get to the next page of the and I don't like to do that. I confess, I like to write fair. I like to write, and of course I'm writing from a single character's perspective, so you are getting increasingly closed in, increasingly claustrophobic, I hope, as Ivy's world shrinks, your world shrinks, and you only know what she knows. She doesn't always take in everything that she's shown. And hopefully the reader will be a little bit quicker on the uptake than she, but she's pregnant.
Yeah. Another, and again, I don't mean this in a negative way, another one of the conventions of mystery writing is the cynical cop who gives the protagonist, the innocent protagonist, hell on earth to deal with.
Yeah.
And you have, is it Detective Blanchard that's in
your
book?
Yes, and he's named after, I have to tell you. We had Mystery Writers of America, the New England chapter, had a president whose name was Al Blanchard, who, by the way, sadly, had a massive heart attack on the day of our conference, our local conference, died right in the middle of the conference. I was sorry. We were all very sorry, but I named the character after Al, so he would have liked that.
I belong to Northwest Chapter, so the loss of a brother member is...
It's a big deal, yeah. But I wanted a character... I don't think he's not a dumb cop, and I hate dumb cops. I hope I didn't write a dumb cop. And he's not a donut-eating cop. He's just a guy trying to do his job, and his job is to figure out where this woman went, and it's obvious that Ivy or David knows something that they're not saying. I mean, he's exactly right.
There's an awful lot of cop work, which is blue collar work. It really is. It's hard work. It's day to day stuff. And if you're a detective, whether it's homicide or robbery or whatever it is, you need to pound the pavement. You need to talk to people. It's grunt work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you briefly, I entertained the thought that he might rescue her, that cop, and rapidly discarded that.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I think that was a wise choice.
Yeah.
We have a couple of minutes left. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a new novel. It's untitled. And it's kind of, again, it's set in the suburbs. I'm trying to, obviously, I like to repeat the success of this book. This book is doing very well.
Mazel tov.
Yeah, thank you. And so I'm trying to go back and channel that kind of suburban noir thing. But in this case, I have a character who is a recluse. She, for various reasons, lives in a room very much like the one we are recording in, full of electronic equipment and monitors. And she can see outside her house, but she doesn't go there. And for a personal reason, she ends up having to leave this sanctuary and go out into the world. So I kind of turning the story that I wrote inside out.
Uh-huh. We're getting an agoraphobic who was forced out of the house. Is that
was forced out of the house, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Good. Yeah. You can give somebody the creeps forever with like that. Yeah. what's it like writing alone? I mean, you've written with a partner before.
I think the hardest thing for me approaching writing alone was being afraid that I wasn't going to have any ideas. When Don and I wrote together, very much the ideas for the book, the themes grew out of his work. He's a neuropsychologist, so we were writing about memory, and we were writing about delusions, and we were writing about dementia, and we were writing about a lot of medical malpractice and drugs and the drug industry and the doctors being in bed together and all that stuff. So it's a million things you can write about when you're writing about that. So when I had to write alone, when we stopped writing together, I just was afraid I wasn't going to have an idea. I knew I could write because Don didn't write. I wrote. He was afraid I was going to want to write. I was afraid he was going to. He was afraid I was going to make him write. And I, of course,
write, damn you.
And I was afraid he was going to want to write. But in fact, I did come up with an idea, and I actually came up with the idea for this book at a yard sale. I mean, I went to a yard sale. The woman invited me to go inside and look around. I went inside and I thought, what if a woman goes to yard sale? She goes inside and she never comes out. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of Never Tell a Lie.
And that's exactly what we've been discussing. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Never Tell a Lie is the title of the book. Hallie Efron, Ephron, is the author, published by Morrow. We expect to see you here in Portland for your next book.
I expect to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome.